Hi, I'm Carla Nappi, and this is New Books in East Asian Studies. Welcome, and thanks very much for joining us today. Now, I just had the pleasure of talking with three amazing scholars who have just produced two beautiful volumes and have a third on the way. This was Eric Taliakatso, Helen Hsio, and Peter Perdue, who have just co-edited two volumes that we talked about today. These both came out with Harvard University Press in 2015, and they are Asia Inside Out, Changing Times, and Asia Inside Out, Connected Places. Both of these volumes bring together a range of different kinds of scholars who are working with text, some of them are working with images, who come from different disciplinary backgrounds, are working on different geographical areas, from different periods, engaging different kinds of source materials, and are having conversations, not just amongst each other, but also with the spaces in which their gatherings, the gatherings that produced the volumes, took place, that generate a very, very different way of picturing, of writing about, of imaging, and of thinking about Asia as a space, as actually a plurality of kinds of space, maritime and on land. And it's a really wonderful way of not just thinking about what it can mean to do this kind of connected collaborative work, but also to see it modeled in action. So as you hear the conversation to come, you'll hear us talking about some of the individual contributions to the volume. You'll hear us talking about the kinds of material and also conceptual resources that made such a conversation possible. And you'll also hear us talk about what's to come. What can we expect from the third volume that's not out yet? And what are the visions of each one of the co-authors for where we might go next? It's a really fascinating project. It's really been inspiring to me very, very much so in terms of how I think about the possible futures of my own work in scholarship. And I'm really grateful to you, listeners, for being part of this conversation as well. So thank you for your support. Thank you for listening. I hope you enjoy, and I will leave you to it. I'm here today to talk with Eric Taliakatso, Helen Hsio, and Peter Perdue about their new edited volumes, Asia Inside Out, Connected Places, and Asia Inside Out, Changing Times. And we'll also be talking about the third coming volume in the series. Welcome to New Books in East Asian Studies, you three, and thanks very much for being with me today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So let's start by giving listeners a sense of how the project started and how you all came to it. Helen, would you mind starting us off by explaining really the genesis of the project that's generated these two volumes so far?
Yeah, sure. Let me say a few words since I started this whole thing. Just a little background and our key concerns. I mean, 15 years ago, actually, sitting at Yale, I was sensing that the center of gravity of Asian studies was moving to Asia. And so I set up a platform in Hong Kong, out of all places, to try to facilitate such move. And I was quite determined to promote interdisciplinary and interregional research and to build a critical community of like-minded colleagues and our graduate students who wish to be conceptually creative. And that was about 2001. But by 2006, I was feeling that Asian scholars were getting too China-focused. Mm-hmm. And so I decided to take off in the opposite direction. That is to explore a broadly defined Asia all the way to the Middle East and Africa. And in fact, it dovetailed with other activities initiated by some of our partners today. First, Social Science Research Council in New York. And it was organizing activities to rethink regional studies and, of course, with all the funding implications. And so, in fact, in 2008, 150 of us met in Dubai. In 2010, another group, a similar number, met in Singapore. 2012, we met in Hong Kong. 2013, we met in Istanbul. And then the next year, we're hoping to meet in Seoul. So in a sense, you know, all these activities in these intervening years make us feel that teamwork is absolutely necessary, because we really cannot cover this entire region on our own. And so in 2008, I think, Eric, correct me if I'm wrong, and I approached Eric and later Peter to join me in this venture, because there's a reason for it, because we all worked on the quote-unquote margins of the Asia landmass. Peter chasing after the nomads in China's northwest and Central Asia. Eric and I chasing after mobile water-based populations along the southeastern coast, all the way, you know, from East Asia down to Southeast Asia. These people were probably branded as merchants or boatmasters in times of peace, but then in times of turmoil, they are seen as traffickers of all sorts, and rebels, pirates, and so on. And so we thought that we have a perfect, you know, triangle here, covering north, south, east, west of this landmass we call Asia. And so I allocated about $200,000, I think, Eric. Did I give you that much?
It wasn't given to me personally, but yes, it was given over to the project.
We gave our team, you know, from this Hong Kong Institute for the Humanities and Social Sciences, which I set up in Hong Kong. So we have a budget, and we organized several groups of colleagues, you know, who are all also doing very unusual empirical and archival work, both for historical and contemporary topics. And so we organized, we plan to organize three workshops, and each of the workshop would have a field trip associated with it, so that we walk the field together as well. And with all that, we hoped to be able to rethink or reconceptualize the entire idea of Asia, looking at it not just as a landmass with static bounded, state-centered economies and cultures, but to see it as more like an assemblage of historical processes, highlighting flows of goods, people, ideas, and all that, you know, kind of stuff, you know, emphasizing fluidity and contingency. And so always boundary crossing. And, you know, some of the major boundary crossing themes would have to do with challenging very Eurocentric ideas about landmasses or continental divides, you know, in world history, you know, East versus West, or even divides like East Asia, Southeast Asia, South Asia, or and so on. So we would like to loosen up those kind of static categories. At the same time, we want to loosen up land versus sea dichotomies, you know, because we always feel that if we can combine the Mediterranean and the Indian Ocean and the China Seas, you know, and looking at all the connections, you know, among them, we have a very different Asia altogether. And so, in a sense, what we have been trying to do is, on the one hand, finding very, very deeply empirical cases, deeply critical reading of archives, to do the kind of research to challenge, you know, large, you know, conceptual categories, and hopefully to force a kind of paradigm change. And so, at the, you know, as we were producing the first volume, I think Peter initiated, actually, with our urging, to approach Harvard University Press, stretching the need for teamwork and the need for edited volumes for this kind of work. And the editor believes us. So hence, we have the volumes. You know, one on moments of connection, the other on sites of connection, and then the third one coming will be on institutions and peoples of connection. And hopefully in future, we would like to do more, creating more and more, curriculum, classes, encouraging younger scholars and our graduate students to join in. So that's more or less, how we got ourselves into this project, in a nutshell.
Great. Thank you so much. Now let's actually just move right to the first volume, and we can kind of incorporate and hear from you individually along the way as you're inspired to. So this first volume on moments of connection is the volume Changing Times. And this volume asks us to consider moments, dates that marked, as you call them, significant inflection points when certain major cultural processes changed direction. And this is from the introduction. The volume includes contributions by historians, by art historians and anthropologists, and it's quite a wonderful set of curated moments and years that you've brought us into. Peter, can you tell us a little bit about your vision for the volume? And can you introduce the volume for us in terms of the most important contributions that you think it's making to our collective conversation?
Sure. Yeah, I could give you a bit of overview of this. As Helen said, we were trying to get past inherited orthodox conceptions, both of time and space in Asia. I would say these are not only Eurocentric, but even Asocentric, because Asian nationalism, which predominates in all of these modern nation states, reinforces many of these boundaries of the nation state. And every nation state had its own nationalist history, which focuses often on crucial turning points. In China, of course, it would be 1842, for example, the end of the First Opium War. Part of the idea of the first volume was to leave it open to each of the contributors to pick a date that they thought was significant, but not tell them what date to pick, and encourage people to open their minds to alternative choices from the standard historical narrative. And sure enough, fortunately, we were very gratified to see that people took very unusual dates much of the time, or they took a conventional date and reinterpreted it. You wouldn't think of 1874 as a significant date in the history of Japan. Everyone would focus on 1868, the Meiji Restoration. But in 1874, a kind of new export trading regime based on tea, as Robert Hellyer describes it, started to take hold. And that is arguably when Japan really enters the global economy. When I wrote about 1557, which is when the Portuguese negotiated their lease in Macau, people know that date, but I pointed out that this was also the beginning of the resolution of the southeastern so-called dwarf pirates issue and the beginning of the resolution of the northwest frontier. So we could take this one date that's embedded in just one literature, say, about foreign relations with the Portuguese, but connected to many other places around the borders of the Chinese Empire. So I think this was a nice strategy for getting people to rethink and to sort of point out different inflection points that would make you put these individual countries and empires into a larger world perspective.
Thank you so much. And thanks for bringing up also your contribution to the volume, which is one of the three early essays, or rather one of your many contributions to the volume since you planned and edited this. But you can, in addition to all of that work, you contributed one of three early essays that look at key turning points, again, as articulated in the introduction, in religious, economic, and political formations in the early to mid-16th century. Now, in your particular chapter on 1557, as you brought us into, one of the really interesting methodological contributions that the chapter's making, in addition to taking us into this fascinating moment, is you're showing us another way to think about and to practice comparative history. Now, comparative history is a kind of historiography that has a lot of challenges to it, right? And there's been a lot of debate and conversation around the benefits and also the challenges of practicing comparative history. But at a larger level, usually people are thinking in terms of civilizational comparisons, not in terms of these really fascinating finer grained comparisons that look at a particular moment from different boundaries and from the perspective.
Yes, that's right. I think that comparative history is a rising trend these days. There's lots of debates about methodologies of comparative history these days. Broadly speaking, some people do what I would call binary history. They take two places generally that are often quite different and far away from each other, and they go back and forth and compare relative features of each place, say, Ancien Régime France and Imperial China, for example, or England and Japan. And then there's what people call entangled history, or histoire croisée in French, that looks at interactions between different places, often focuses on trade routes and transnational other processes. Each of these has its plus and minuses. In my article, I think I'm trying to do a little bit of both, because I take comparisons of different borders of China. So we're looking at different places within and on the border of the Chinese Empire, but argue that they are connected to each other and to global processes. So the Europeans are coming in to trade. The Chinese migrants from the southeast are going out to the diaspora. The pirates are there. The nomads are there all around this particular moment in the mid-16th century. I think this helps give us a focus to some of these larger scale theoretical paradigm comparisons on a particular place and time. And it also brings in some of the interactivity that the people doing entangled history want to do.
Thanks so much. And I think one of the wonderful things about that essay is it's also modeling for us what that kind of a connected comparative history can look like. So there are also many other fabulous essays in this volume. Those three essays that I just mentioned that focus on the 16th century are followed by three essays that collectively look at developments in three major maritime-oriented polities in the 17th and 18th centuries. And then we have three essays that look at late 19th and early 20th centuries. And Eric, you actually have a contribution in the book that constitutes one of those essays. And this is an essay on the Dutch East Indies in 1910. Now, you compare the approach in this essay of looking at a single year in the life cycle of a society to dendrology, to a tree ring approach to the history of place and people. So, Eric, can you introduce us to your contribution to this volume? And specifically, what do you think are some of the most important ways that your essay is speaking to the larger problems of the project, and how does this dendrology approach kind of inflect what you're doing here in this essay?
Thank you for the question. I think the idea of dendrochronology is kind of an interesting way of looking at history, and we're certainly not the first people to have done this. Peter actually makes a reference in his article to a title of an important book in Chinese history that looked at that was titled A Year of No Significance. And he makes a nice riff on that by talking about 1557 as being a year of some significance. I think, you know, historians or people working in other fields can take any year and find some significance to it. But I think what was a conscious attempt of this collectivity of authors was to look at years that weren't the ones that were taught in school. Peter mentioned 1868 and the Meiji Restoration in Japan. That's what everybody goes to think about processes of modernity in Japan. So by Robert Hellyer, one of our authors, taking 1874, it signals thinking about different things. And for Dutch Indonesia, the dates tend to be also fairly commonly ascribed, which are the common dates. 1910 is interesting for me because it's about that time that the Dutch East Indies were taking on the shape that modern Indonesia more or less has today. If we go back 100 years from our own time to right at this moment, the Dutch East Indies underwent a process that in Dutch is called the afronding, or rounding off. And another author has used that term to describe what happened. And I think it's useful to think about that because it's almost like looking at a mirror 100 years ago for what Indonesia started to grow into at that time. So I was interested in the set of processes that were very international and transnational, that involved a lot having to do with migration and the powers of the state, people coming to the Indies that weren't necessarily Bhumiputras or sons of the soil. They were coming from China, they were coming from Japan, they were coming from India and the Middle East, and they were passing through this incredible assemblage of 17,000 islands, the world's largest archipelago, moving between what we describe as East Asia and South Asia or West Asia, and moving very, very easily through this kind of very permeable maritime space at the bottom of Asia. So I was interested in that kind of theme, but we see some of those similar concerns in a number of the other essays in this book, certainly in Kerry Ward's essay about the Indian Ocean, but also in a number of the other essays, Nancy Umm's contribution about Yemen and how Yemen was connected to so many places through coffee and through pilgrimage and radials of Islam. So the maritime element is very important in what many of us have done in these essays.
And in fact, one of the constant themes, both in your piece and also throughout this volume and in the other volume, which we'll get to in a moment, is the importance of looking at what was happening both on land and in the sea, and in fact, the importance and the possibilities that are opened up in thinking beyond land and sea as a dichotomy, right, as coherent kinds of space. And a lot of what's happening in these volumes is a really wonderfully productive way of breaking down the land-sea binary and asking us to think more connectedly and more kind of collaboratively about those sorts of movements that are enabled by both kinds of space.
Right.
Okay. So in the introduction to the book, you all mentioned that the regions studied in this project needed a much more, as you put it, interactive, collaborative style of research. Now, it seems to me that that both involved collaboration among one another, individuals from very different fields in some cases, but also a collaboration among yourselves and the spaces in which you were gathering and meeting to actually have these conversations. So one of the things I'd love to hear about is how you feel about the importance of your collaborations with the non-human and other, you know, human based environments around you as you were meeting in these different sites and walking together and experiencing the field. How did it shape what you were doing in the volume to be meeting in, you know, Doha or meeting in Qatar, meeting in Oman, meeting in these different spaces? Helen, would you like to start speaking to that perhaps?
Well, being an anthropologist among the historians, I'm always, you know, pushing for getting out of the archives and looking at how those historical materials were actually constructed in real historical times. So, I mean, a lot of what we see as history is very selective, right? Mm-hmm. To be selectively remembered and then selectively recorded, made and then reread again. So what we're trying to do as a team of mostly historians, anthropologists and so on is to how would I say it, to see the value in, you know, of our own disciplines in the others' research. And so we, for the workshops, I mean, for this volume, we actually had our workshop in Hong Kong. Itself is a city with multi-layered histories and moments of, you know, thin and thick moments of construction. And then the group went to southwestern India on the advice of Eric because we really want to use the feel as we watch, you know, from Bangalore all the way down to the tip of Kerala, to actually see layers of historical processes making that larger regional space. So in a sense, for me as an anthropologist, looking at sort of material objects in real life, but at the same time, understanding how they were made in very different moments in time. So I think that's a very eye-opening way of learning about history through fieldwork. Mm-hmm. So that's one way of answering the question.
Yes.
No, I just add, I think historians need to get their feet on the ground, either wet or dirty. There's the famous anecdote by the French historian Marc Bloch, who had a teacher who read documents and archives and claimed that there was never any three-field system in France. And Bloch comments, if he had only looked out his study window, he could have seen the three-field system in the fields outside. But the real world didn't make much impression on him. That was Bloch's teacher. Bloch said, you have to get out there into the fields, plural, that is, agrarian fields, or the water, or somewhere, you know, to connect the writings and the archives with the places you actually are. And then if you're in a different place, which you're not studying, a marvelous place like Oman, suddenly you see, well, some things you thought were unique to, say, the Chinese hills are also there in the Omani hills. You know, the water systems actually look fairly similar. So you encounter other kinds of resonances and connections that you wouldn't otherwise think about.
Mm-hmm. And in fact, a gathering in Oman, if I'm not incorrect, spurred or is one of the events that brought about the second volume, right, that we haven't had a chance to talk about that yet. This is a second installment called Connected Places, which showcases essays that collectively emphasize connectedness and motion by looking at a series of spatial moments. Helen, would you mind bringing us into your vision for this volume?
I sort of mentioned a little bit already that we are talking about space in the context of time, actually. So we are talking about like spatial moments in a sense. So, you know, time is never abstract, right? Time is always spatially, you know, interpreted, I would say. So, yeah, I mean, the volume, the second volume, focuses on sites at which I think cross-regional institutions flourished. And it actually, you know, we started thinking about this volume very much based on something I have done earlier, and I think both Eric and Peter were familiar, is another volume I did much earlier with two other historians. It's called Empire at the Margins. Mm-hmm. And we're really looking at sites, again, sites that are rather unfamiliar or considered marginal, considered in between. But in fact, they were hubs of connections, dense with all sort of things flowing in and out and affecting, you know, a much larger hinterland. And so in a sense, when we look at these sites, they are not like a homogeneous area like the corn belt or wheat belt or whatever, but instead these are sites with very structural processes happening all the time. And so that's how we were thinking about how to think, to think in physical terms. So deserts and other, you know, areas, you know, like Oman might look very, very empty for some of us. But in fact, deserts were full of meanings, full of life, and full of all sorts of activities and so on. So in a sense, again, we are thinking about sites just as in the first volume, we're thinking about moments, you know, sites that look like margins, look like empty spaces, but in fact were places with a lot of histories in them. And so we started with that, and a major theme is on land-based dichotomies, because if you really think about our mainstream social science, and I don't know about historians, but I imagine similarly, for social sciences, we tend to build cultures, populations, territories, economies, polities on land-based units, and we missed out the ocean. And so historians and like Karen Wiggum and geographers like Martin Lewis, they were talking about the myth of continents. You know, in trying to divert our divert our attention to the ocean, the vast ocean spaces. But it's like jumping to the other side of the coin. So what we want to do is to really bridge the maritime and the land. One way to do it is actually thinking about deltas, river deltas. If you look at Asia, I mean, from Yangtze River Delta in middle, you know, sort of eastern China, all the way down, you know, through, you know, to think about marsh gypsies in Iraq and whatever. I mean, you see lots of areas that is, you know, sort of water, but always in the process of becoming land. Mm-hmm. And so it's that interactive, processual, fluid, contingent kind of sites that we would like to focus on. And you can tell in our volume two, there are a few of the essays that are based on these kind of places.
And some of those essays are actually authored by some of you. We won't have time to talk in any detail about those individual contributions, but I'd just like to mark them for listeners who might be interested. So Helen, you have a co-authored essay in here that focuses on a really fascinating local township, Gazetteer, which really takes us into some really, really interesting issues of kind of the indigenous settlement of Chaoyan, and also asks us to think about what we can gather from a source, a gazetteer like this. And Peter has a fascinating essay that looks at four male travelers who are experiencing border crossings in 18th century China. And it really, among other things, asks us to think about frontiers and borders as cultural and social spaces, as processes. And it's a really wonderfully, again, polyvocal entree into thinking about this connected and comparative histories. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot more going on in this volume that we can talk about, right? But there's, of course, a third volume coming out as well. And so we don't want to neglect the opportunity to learn a little bit about that one. Eric, could you maybe take us into your vision for the third volume? What is that going to emphasize? And how is that volume going to, when it eventually comes out, speak to and extend some of the conversations that we've already been having and that you've already been having in the first two volumes?
Right. Well, I think the all along the collective vision has been that we're going to try to do this as a three-volume set. And the reason for that is that we felt, you know, thinking about Asia inside out as such a large compendium of geographies, people, spaces, moments, as both Helen and Peter have described, it's just beyond any one scholar to really do that kind of day and age where someone can talk about these kinds of things in such a confident way is just about over. There's very few people who can do that anymore. But as a collectivity of 30, 35, 36 authors, let's say roughly 12 per volume, we thought this is going to be amazing that we would be able to gather that expertise of archives, languages, fieldwork experiences into one tripartite, a kind of triptych almost of what is possible in thinking about this huge region, the world's largest continent and its history and contemporary moments of connection. So that has been something that we've thought from the beginning. And right from the start, the idea was to focus the first volume on the temporal aspect of this and rethink some of the important moments of connection. The second volume was going to be about place and spatiality and how would this would look vis-a-vis geography. And the third volume, which we're in the process of working on now, has to really do with human actors actually making up the connective tissue between these places. So what we've looked at in kind of these metastructural terms so far, we're now going to try to end the series by putting flesh on the bones, so to speak, with human beings, human actions, human history, human activity. And we have a notion of what we'd like this to look like. We haven't completely organized it yet, but we have a sense that because the first volume took place in India for the field trip that we all experienced together, the second volume took place in West Asia, so from South Asia to West Asia, that the last one is going to have either an East or a Southeast Asian component to try to kind of spread the wealth among the different parts of Asia. So that's what we're hoping to do.
So Eric, for you, we've already heard a little bit about this from Helen and from Peter. For you, has the fact that you've been meeting in these different spaces qualitatively changed your vision for the project? And or in what ways do you feel like the collaboration among not just all of you, but among yourselves and the spaces in which you've been working and meeting, how have you felt like that's been shaping your vision for the project?
Right. Well, look, it's a huge opportunity. To do something like this just realistically involves a lot of money. And I don't happen to have that money myself, but I thankfully I happen to know Professor Hsu.
Eric.
She actually has been really integral. I mean, both Peter and Helen have been integral in different parts of the project. They're really amazingly well-read people and with incredible broad horizons. But nothing happens without money. And Helen's contacts really got this project off the ground in the beginning for the three of us. And that there's just no way to proceed without something like that. And I think when we approached Harvard about the books, you know, the tendency in publishing is to get smaller and smaller and smaller. Make your books smaller, make the ideas smaller, because you're covering your own space that you're going to be an expert and make your contribution. And they want the physical books to be smaller because the presses have ideas about, you know, selling thousands and thousands of copies. And that's only possible if the books are affordable. And we, as a collective of the three of us, we took the opposite task. We said, we're going to get bigger and bigger and bigger.
And volume two is almost 90 pages longer than volume
that's
one.
Right.
I don't know if it should follow this to volume three.
That's right. That's right. We might be getting off. Pages. Exactly. Might be getting off the stage entirely. But I think the idea is it's a kind of, if I can say this, it's a kind of humility that is born out of the fact that there's only so much you can do as a single scholar. But if you team up with smart people, both in your discipline and in other disciplines, both in your geography and in other geographies, the limits become much larger of what you can achieve. And what we hope is that as a collectivity of three books, that people will look at this and say, wow, Asia is not what I thought it was. Asia is actually all of these spinning geographies, spinning people, times that we never thought were important, but turned out to be really crucial in hindsight, even though it doesn't say so in the textbook I read as a child. And look how we can reconceive of this space. If we've done anything to start a conversation like that or to continue a conversation like that, then I think all three of us would be very grateful.
Do either Helen or Peter, do either of you want to speak to the third volume or the larger issues that Eric was mentioning?
I just say that, well, the people also appear in the Places and Times volumes, and Places and Times appear in the People volumes. So they're not radically separate from each other, of course. Mm-hmm. They have a common perspective and a common goal to sort of rethink spaces, times, and peoples all together within Asia. Mm-hmm. And yeah. I think back to the other collective volumes, the famous volumes, G. William Skinner and Elvin edited on the city in Imperial China. Those were major volumes defining the Chinese urban history. Those were very valuable in defining a certain moment and a certain way of looking at things. But they were on one place in one empire. Now, this is something much more ambitious, but in some ways more modest, because all of us, we don't have one single paradigm to impose on everybody. Everyone follows their own trail, and yet we think it overlaps enough and creates enough resonance to make it worthwhile. And I think will inspire more people beyond the 35 or so we have in these three volumes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And if there, just to kind of look ahead, and as we come toward the conclusion of our conversation, right? If you can believe that, right? We're almost already there.
Yeah, we've
talked a lot about the ways that these three volumes are collectively accomplishing way more than any single scholar can accomplish, and way more than perhaps a singly authored piece, written in a particular place or from a particular place can accomplish. Is there anything that any of you feel that you would have loved to be able to do in this project, but that hasn't yet happened, and in a future project, in terms of your vision for where do we go from here? In an ideal world, if you had $1 billion, right, of Helen's coffers, what would you love to see happen after this third volume? Where do we go from here? And what vision, if at all, do any of you have for what you'd like to see happening that didn't yet happen with these projects?
Well, if I had the funding and we were moving in this direction, I would put it all on the web and make interactive maps of all the things going on here. We are always stuck with books, with static maps, when we're talking about flows and interactions and changes over time, one map in a book is not going to do it. We have put also visual pictures. We put a lot of great photos by Helen and others in the book to indicate the importance of visualization. And I hope people do buy the book with the beautiful covers on them so they can see the pictures there. But a lot of this on the web would be incredibly exciting. And if we had the funding to design a website around it, I think that would be very exciting to do.
Mm-hmm. Eric, what would you envision as your kind of ideal way to move forward from the project? Or is there anything you wished you would have been able to do that you'd love to do in the future?
Well, I think that, the amount of money involved to make this project a reality really has kind of made it a kind of dream come true scenario in some ways. We all got to travel to places that were not our specialty landscapes, not the places that we knew best. That's been a very, very important part of this for me. In terms of what comes next, I can just say that, my next monograph has been very influenced by this and my thinking about it. And this is just a standalone, one scholar monograph has been very influenced by my experiences doing this project with Helen and Peter, because it's opened my eyes to certain things that I hadn't thought of before. Thinking like an anthropologist, thinking like a sinologist, all these possibilities that are not my normal, ontology. So I think that's really been very valuable and very useful for me.
So, Eric, if I could just ask you to expand a little bit, can you think of what's an example of something concrete that you're doing now in this monograph that you're working on that you would not have done were it not for this experience with this project?
Right. I think one of it is just really being serious about going to all the places and not just writing about them. I mean, I'm a historian, and there are certain limits to being a historian. Some of that has to do with languages and archives. Some of it also has to do, just to be honest, about your own life cycle. And I'm a kind of mid-career scholar. I have small children. I have a mortgage. I have all these kinds of things. I have duties at my university. I run several programs. So it's not that easy for me to get out and do things as it used to be when I was younger. And it might be a little bit easier when I'm older to go full circle and do this kind of thing again. So I think one of the things that this project has kind of hit home in my consciousness is that you need to go to places to understand more. So I had been to the Middle East several times, but I had not had, time to go to a place like Oman and really have a much more leisurely look around at certain things that were interesting to me. And I could name a bunch of different things. We don't really have the time to go into specifics, but I'll just say one thing as an example is going to a coastal city named Sur, S-U-R. That was a very meaningful place to me because it showed in a lot of little ways how connected places that we think of as being very much off the main routes of connection can be. When we got to Sur, we went to this giant fish market there. And in addition to standing around and trying to write down the kinds of fish that I saw, because I'm interested in maritime things generally, we saw a coffee shop outside of the the fish market that advertised in Bahasa Indonesia. And I knew that because I'm an Indonesianist. So there are clearly Indonesians who are workers in Oman. And that was new to me. I had no idea about that. And I wouldn't have known that unless I had gone to Oman.
Wonderful. And Helen, we only have a couple of minutes left, but if you could briefly kind of maybe bring us home by saying, if there's any way that your work now is influenced by this project or where you'd like to see it going in the future.
Yeah, well, I haven't totally defected to the history discipline yet, but I'm sure people already see me very much in that camp. I think in the future, I really want to continue these kind of efforts, not, you know, the Asia Inside Out project, but other similar crossing boundaries kind of projects involving younger colleagues and advanced grad students, encouraging our colleagues to start teaching courses that way. I know I do have one called Cultures and Markets in, you know, talking about Asian kind of themes. And so once you build that into curriculum, we work with SSRC to make sure that eventually funding models may change and redrawing regional boundaries for funding. That will be tremendously important for nurturing a younger generation of scholars along these kind of paradigm shift. So, I mean, the one last thing is I am already taking on a new project on China-Africa, but it's not China-Africa in terms of two continents, but instead China-Africa via this very rich, complex, interconnected, interracial landscape. Well, that is very different from the existing China-Africa kind of literature. So I think there's tremendous potential for expansion.
Well, thank you to all three of you for bringing us into this project, for giving us some background and insight into these volumes, and the best of luck to you, not only on your individual work, but also on the third volume. We'll really look forward to reading that and hopefully perhaps talk again. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Thanks very much.
You've been listening to New Books in East Asian Studies. Thanks very much for joining us, and we'll see you next time.